This is Pittsburgh Explainer, a new podcast from 90.5 WESA. We bring you the biggest news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania every Friday. Thanks for joining us for our very first episode. I'm your host, Liz Reed.
And I'm Chris Potter, editor of the Government and Accountability section.
I'm Anlie Herring. I cover the courts, criminal justice, and county government.
And I'm Ariel Worthy. I cover city council and the Peduto administration.
It's Friday, February 7th. This week, musical chairs on the board of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, how some city council members unknowingly improved the mayor's move to swap out one of their colleagues for another. And the trial got underway in a 2016 mass shooting at a Wilkinsburg cookout. We'll take a look at the case against Sharon Shelton, one of the two defendants charged in the crime. Finally, city council gets to work on the parks tax voters approved last fall. We'll dig into these stories right after the break.
On Saturday, February 22nd, the Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting Community Food Connections Initiative will be hosting a check-in for the 15th annual Southside Soup Contest at 67 Bedford Square, the home of WYEP and WESA. Bring a non-perishable food item to the station for the Brashear Association Food Pantry and check in for the contest from 11:30 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. The contest is a fundraiser for the Brashear Association and Southside Chamber of Commerce. For more information, visit WYEP.org/food.
This is Pittsburgh Explainer. I'm Liz Reed. We'll start this week with Government and Accountability Editor Chris Potter and reporter Ariel Worthy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How did this change on the PWSA board first come to your attention, Ariel?
It was a quick agenda item on Tuesday's City Council meeting. It wasn't made totally clear that Councilor Erica Strasburger was replacing Councilor Deb Gross, but that's kind of what I put together. It was kind of implied that she would be replacing her.
Council President Smith presents Bill Number 92. Resolution appointing Erica Strasburger as a member of the Board of Directors of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority for a term to expire March 31st, 2022.
Yeah, they did a voice vote, and even Councilor Deb Gross, she was actually on the phone, she wasn't there in person. She even voted to approve Erica Strasburger. And then Council President Teresa Kill Smith made this statement.
I'm just briefly going to mention this. Councilwoman Gross, who served on the PWSA board for a very long time, did a really great job in making sure she worked with us on those concerns. But I think that, to me, there is no better scenario than to have Councilwoman Strasburger and Councilwoman Gross together on any board or even working separately and independently.
So on Wednesday, after the standing committee meeting, I actually grabbed Councilor Deb Gross, and I just kind of asked her about her time on the board, and she said, "I'm still on the board."
And Chris, you're laughing. This is when you sort of took over the reporting because Ariel was focused on the parks tax, which we'll discuss later. What did Gross say when you talked to her later?
She reiterated that as far as she knew, she was still on the board. And the sort of complicating factor here is the PWSA board has seven seats on it. And one of those seats has been vacant for going on to more than 2 years now. It's been vacant since December of 2017. Councilwoman Gross's representation is she thought that Councilwoman Strasburger was being appointed to fill that vacant seat, not to replace her, Deb Gross. And the resolution just said, it didn't mention Deb Gross at all. It just said to fill a term that expires in March of 2022. That is Deb Gross's term. And Deb has basically been serving as on an expired term. Her stint on the board officially ended in 2018. It's not unusual for board members to continue serving on after that. But what it means is that the person who appointed them, the mayor in this case, has the ability to kind of yank them at any time.
So what reason did the mayor's office give for the swap?
What they said is that Erica Strasburger has a background in environmental issues prior to her work in city government. She had worked with Penn Environment and some other environmental advocacy groups for about a decade, that she had expertise in this and that it made a lot of sense to put somebody like that on city council. What I was not able to determine is, you know, why it was necessary to remove Deb Gross, whether Deb had somehow failed in her tasks in their view or anything like that. I got no sense of that. It's not entirely clear at this point. The question people are going to have is like, well, what does this matter? Will this change the direction of the board? Ms. Strasburger and Ms. Gross are very much on the same page on a lot of issues. There has been some talk in the past, some concern about in the long term, should we privatize the PWSA, for example? And I think people are going to, you know, wonder if that's, you know, what's in back of all this in some way. Ms. Strasburger told me on Wednesday evening, you know, Deb and I see eye to eye on this. I'm very skeptical of any attempt to either privatize the asset or contract out to a third party vendor to provide management services. So right now it looks as though there won't be a big change in direction. direction here. But then it's not clear then exactly why the administration felt a need to shift council representation there.
What does this say about city governance? I mean, city councilors could say that the mayor's office should have notified them that they actually intended to replace Gross on the board. But I could see the mayor's office arguing, well, as councilors, you have a responsibility to do your due diligence before you take these votes and to ask what we're voting on.
First of all, the administration did tell Council President Smith, hey, we've got a bill coming up next week. It will be to replace Deb Gross with Erica Strasburger. Teresa Cale Smith acknowledged, yeah, they did tell me that. They weren't trying to pull a fast one. But that message didn't necessarily get communicated to everybody else on council.
Did the city say anything about their plans to fill that open seat?
As far as I know, the city does not have a plan for finding somebody to fill that seat at this point.
Anlie, this week you covered the trial of Sharon Shelton, who's accused of murdering five people, including a pregnant woman 4 years ago. Can you remind us what happened on that night in Wilkinsburg in 2016?
A group had gathered for a backyard barbecue in Wilkinsburg. They were grilling burgers, taking photos. Someone posted a photo to social media. And then shortly after that, what were believed to be two men ambushed the group from a nearby alleyway, and they fired dozens of shots on this group. Everyone, it was family members, some friends, they started to rush toward the house. Some of them couldn't make it in, and ultimately five adults died, and one of them was a pregnant woman.
How did Sharon Shelton and Robert Thomas become suspects in this crime?
Prosecutors say that there was a flurry of cell phone activity between the two men's phones immediately before and after the attack took place. There also is a detective with the Wilkinsburg Police Department that says that he spotted Sharon Shelton parked in a car within half a block of the home that was ambushed moments after the attack. Investigators also say that they found a cache of weapons at Shelton's mother's home. And they also had some testimony on letters that Shelton sent to family members, his girlfriend, while he was in jail before being charged. And they say it suggests that Shelton regretted doing something wrong, but he never actually confessed in those letters.
But why was the homicide case against Robert Thomas thrown out?
Essentially, the judge, Edward Borkowski, said there wasn't enough evidence to take him to trial. And this came amid revelations late last week that a key witness for the prosecution, a jailhouse informant, had some serious credibility issues. So that was a real concern, and the prosecution decided not to use him in the trial. And absent that, there really was only circumstantial evidence against Thomas.
So how does the case against Shelton differ?
Wilkinsburg detective Michael Adams says he saw Shelton moments after the shooting within the vicinity of the home. And prosecutors say he has a motive for having attacked this group. One of the people in the group, his name is Lamont Powell, and he actually testified this week, Shelton believes murdered Shelton's best friend 3 years before the shooting, so in 2013. The idea that prosecutors would say is that he sought revenge against Lamont Powell. Powell was injured in the attack, and his family members were the ones who died in the attack. And there's also evidence that Shelton had weapons in his home, as I mentioned, but the defense will say that none of those weapons nor the bullets found at his mother's home match the ammunition found at the scene of the crime.
Let's turn now to the parks tax that voters approved in November. Ariel, you've been covering City Council's discussions about how to implement that tax this week. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of bills before council right now. What are they?
Well, one is simply to start collecting the tax. The second one is from Councilor Anthony Coghill and Deb Gross, and it sets up a trust fund for the money. Their bill originally divided the money up nine ways, so each district would get the same amount of money, and they would kind of just decide how they would spend it in their own districts. Here's Anthony Coghill talking about it back on January 21st when they first introduced the bill.
If members have a problem with it, we can amend, we can adjust. I'm the one that personally fought for the nine equal subaccounts, and then for each council person, they can do equitably into their own parks. My district voted heavily against this, and anything less, I will put repairs in my district and parks needs against anybody's district, okay?
This plan to divide up the money 9 equal ways for each council district, that didn't really fly with other members of council, right?
No, even Gross, who co-sponsored the bill with him, didn't agree with it. Councilor Ricky Burgess, he represents some of the lower income communities, some of the communities of color. He's arguing that the parks that need the investment should be the most prioritized. And on Wednesday in city council, he even said, you know, I don't want anything new. I just want the city to do what it promised.
I want to remind you of what it promised. It promised it would generate new resources, up to $20 million a year in new funding, plus sustained investment in the city. I just wanted to do what it promised. It promised it would spend equitably across the city, prioritizing the parks and communities that need it most.
Did the city promise that?
Yeah, it was more so the Parks Conservancy when they were campaigning and lobbying for this tax. They explained that it would go towards more underserved parks in lower income and poorer communities, particularly communities of color. Several of the top 20 parks were in Burgess's district.
So they sold it to the voters as something that would benefit long neglected parks. But who actually decides which parks to prioritize? Is it the Conservancy? Is it the mayoral administration? Is it city council?
That's kind of a question that city council, like, they've been really saying that they're concerned that they want this money to stay in their hands because the public speaks directly to them and they're the ones who get yelled at by the public and they are the ones who are held accountable. So their thing is that they want to be the ones to make this decision. The Conservancy actually said in the fall that it would be council's decision how this money gets spent. But several council members still kind of raise this concern of the Conservancy having their hands in this money. But the Conservancy is like, we're not going to be touching this money. It's really ultimately up to you all.
What role does the Parks Conservancy have in helping to shape this legislation at this point?
The Conservancy, they've actually been kind of quiet through this whole thing. Usually when I reach out to them for anything, they're just like, they decline to comment. But their whole thing they're maintaining is that, like, this is ultimately up to the city. Some councilors, they want to make sure that the promises that were made to the voters come true. But when it comes to, like, Coghill, his thing is like, well, my district needs this money as well.
But I understand he did amend the bill by substitution, and he dropped that, 9 equal parts.
He did. They actually introduced that amendment on Wednesday at the standing committee meeting. The language changed from splitting it equally among all 9 districts to make it providing equitable funding for parks. They've yet to determine how equity will exactly look for the parks, but the language has been updated to state that it will not be split equally.
What's next for this?
They will be holding a public hearing. They have not set a date for it yet, but it'll be within the next few weeks.
And I imagine you will be there when it happens.
I will be there. Yes, I will.
Let's take a quick break when we come back in other news.
From the development of Pittsburgh's distinct neighborhoods to the history of the Civil War here, we'll discuss the city's history and culture at WESA's Good Question Live event. I'm Katie Blackley. Join me for the program on February 19th at the City Theater on the South Side. Get your tickets at WESA.fm.
It's time for our segment called In Other News, where we recommend a story you should check out this week. Chris Potter, what you got?
So I'm halfway into a news story out just this week from The Atlantic. The headline of it is eluding me, but it's something like the $2 billion campaign to disinform the American public. It's basically about Donald Trump and the sort of constellation of special interest independent expenditure groups that are out there investing, especially on social media. The writer McKay Cobbins does this great job of talking about how he himself goes onto Facebook, creates a fake account that, supports like the MAGA sites and, the Trump supporters or whatever, and how even he as a trained journalist, after a few weeks of like getting the updates and all this stuff, starts to question the reality of the fabric of the universe and what he calls sort of censorship by noise. Essentially, that you don't need to censor the truth tellers or the dissidents. You just crowd them out with a whole bunch of other noise that makes it just impossible for people to kind of figure out what's really going on.
And I understand this is something that the Putin administration does in Russia all the time.
Exactly. So you basically kind of create these alternate streams of information, which at the end of the day just sort of convince people that, well, if there's this much out there, none of it can really be all that valuable. And I don't know what to
trust. Or there's no way to know.
Exactly. So I don't know what to trust. So I'm just going to kind of fall back on my ideology to kind of point me in the direction that I think the truth lies, or simply the dictates of the powerful or whatever. And I think we all sort of worry about this in this highly fractured media environment here that, yeah, there's the question of who the next president's going to be. But there's also this question about how any of us know what the heck is going on anywhere about anything. And I think that feels like the kind of existential challenge of the moment we're in.
Ariel, what are you watching this week?
I'm actually just kind of keeping up with this Doug Jones news. Senator Doug Jones.
You are an Alabama native,
right? I am an Alabama native. So I was down there during the special election. He was up against Roy Moore, and it was pretty messy because Roy Moore had been accused of sexual assault, and he still got quite a large number of votes, actually. It was very close. So now Senator Doug Jones is going to be up for a re-election soon. And he actually just voted to convict Trump. And, you know, even though he's a Democrat, a lot of people were still outraged because he represents a very red state.
Have you heard from people from home about this?
Oh, yeah.
What did they think?
A couple of people were shocked that he did vote to convict him because of kind of just how he had been voting on certain other things. But a lot of people ultimately weren't because, like I said, he's a Democrat and it was kind of expected for him to vote to convict him.
Did people think he had a chance of being reelected? I just assume that because, like you said, against Roy Moore, a guy with this just bizarre and horrific resume, and he still barely eked it out. Were people thinking that he was kind of a dead man walking anyway, or did people really think he had a shot of being reelected this fall?
It's kind of 50-50. Honestly, a lot of people thought, well, he might actually have a chance because he is a little bit more conservative compared to other Democrats. But also it was like, well, there's going to be other Republicans running and people will vote red just because in Alabama.
Anlie, what's something you think we should check out this week?
The Indicator podcast, which NPR's Planet Money team produces, had a pretty interesting episode this week. I believe it was Tuesday. But they highlight research by these two economists that show that happiness is closely correlated with age. And this is a global phenomenon they found in both developed and developing countries. People become progressively less happy as they get older. And around age 47 or 48, it really reaches the lowest point on average.
Why is everyone in this room looking at me right now? What's
Chris,
happening?
We know you're beyond this point. So that's good news because they found it's a U-shaped curve, meaning that after around age 47.2, to be precise, people start to become increasingly happier again.
Why did they say like why you start like becoming really sad?
I have a hunch.
Well, there are some different hypotheses around this. I think a common explanation people might give is that as you get older, you know, growing up's really hard for one thing. Say someone goes off to college and they're on their own for a while. Maybe they're feeling a little uncertain and more pressure and stress. And then you get a job. Then you might have student loan debt. You own a home. There are just all these stresses, the stresses of being a parent. But because this research found that this trend applies to developing nations as well, like, that's probably not quite right. And the economist that was on The Indicator said his best guess is that people, until they get to about age 47, start to increasingly realize that they're not going to fulfill all their aspirations in life.
Wow, boy.
But once they get past that point, they reach some level of acceptance and they realize it's okay. And
they settle, learn. I think is what you're trying to say.
Yes, yeah, that is one way of putting it. And you actually might embrace your life and learn to be happy with what you have.
My hunch, and this is probably a very Western perspective and maybe just very specific to my life, but let's just say hypothetically you have your first kid around age 30. Age 48 is when they move out.
Yeah.
So to me, that makes sense that you start getting back on the upswing at that point.
I can provide only anecdotal evidence. I would say that my life got better around age 48, but that's because I started working here.
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Thanks to my guest, Chris Potter.
Good to be with you.
Ariel Worthy.
Thank you.
And Anlie Herring.
Thanks, Liz. Very excited to be part of the first episode of Pittsburgh Explainer.
Thanks, Anlie. Our show is produced and engineered by Katie Blackley. I'm your host, Liz Reed. You can find all of WESA's reporting on our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. Thanks for listening. See you next week.